took you a while there.
Sorry, I was laughing too hard about it.
Call the House Committee on Sustainability and Economic Development to order. Today is the 17th of February. We have a busy agenda. We'll take up House Resolution 2 quickly and then get on to our informational hearing about the BETC, Business Energy Tax Credit. So open a public hearing on House Resolution 2. Barbara.
H.R. 2 commemorates the 104th anniversary of Rotary International, delineates the size and scope of the organization internationally as well as within the state, extends gratitude to Oregon's 131 Rotarian clubs for their service projects throughout Oregon and beyond.
Thank you. We have two folks who have signed up to testify, so I'll invite you both up at the same time, Christy Halverson and Salvatore Mangione. I hope I've pronounced that correctly. Please go ahead, and if you would start by introducing yourself for the record, that'd be great.
Good afternoon. My name is Christy Halverson. I'm from Sherwood, Clackamas County, and I'm the district governor-elect for our Rotary District 5100, which encompasses the northern part of Oregon. In Oregon, we have 143 clubs and over 8,200 members who volunteer their time and talent to further Rotary's motto, Service Above Self. I am testifying today in support of H.R. 2, which commemorates Rotary International's 104th birthday next week on February 23rd. Our mission is to provide service to others, to provide high ethical standards, and to advance world understanding, peace, and goodwill through the fellowship of business, professional, and community leaders. Clubs in Oregon participate in numerous community and international programs and projects involving youth, literacy, health, hunger, water, and the environment. All Rotarians support Rotary's core values, which is service, fellowship, diversity, integrity, and diversity and leadership. House Resolution 2 is a wonderful gesture for all the good work that Oregon Rotarians are doing. Thank you today for the opportunity to encourage the passage of this resolution. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Mangione?
Chair Reed, members of the committee, I am Sam Mangione from Sherwood, Oregon, and I am an assistant district governor of Rotary District 5100, the Southeast region, which is one of 10 regions, and I'm also a past centennial president of East Portland Rotary. I am testifying today in support of H.R. 2, which commemorates Rotary International's 104th birthday on February 23rd. Our community service projects go year-round and involve every member to the extent they are willing and able to participate. Below are just a few of the projects: Meals on Wheels, Salvation Army bell ringing, Goodwill Good Turn Day, Rebuilding Together, Mentoring Youth at Risk, Disaster Relief, Foster Children, Start Making a Reader Today, the Dictionary Project, and the Centennial Community Project. I read the following on a Rotary website. Yes, we are a busy club, but when we serve in fellowship with each other, the work seems easy. We are looking for new hands to help, new ideas for service projects, and new hearts to care. This is how we all feel. Thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I would be more than happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? I think you've given a good summary. We appreciate your testimony. Thanks for being here. With that, there's no one else who has signed up. I don't see a rush of people toward the front to testify on House Resolution 2, so close the public hearing and open work session on House Resolution 2. Representative Belizio?
Mr. Chair, I move House Resolution 2 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Galizio moves House Resolution 2 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation, I think. Is there any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection? Seeing none. Motion carries. House Resolution 2 goes to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Is there anyone who would like to carry? I'm going to have to cold call here. This is... Representative Gilliam, you are writing furiously.
I am.
Are you preparing your floor speech?
No, I just, yes, I was just writing a couple things about some Rotary folks in Silverton. It would be my honor to carry this if you'd like me to.
Thank you, Representative Gilliam. Representative Gilliam will carry, and we'll close the work session on House Resolution 2. open a work session on the business energy, not a work session, an informational hearing. Excuse me. It's work. It feels like work because we're talking about.
That's right. There's a lot to talk about.
You want a motion?
Yeah, not yet. Okay. Thank you. Representative Colesio. An informational hearing on the business energy tax credit. And we have a long list of experts who are going to help enlighten us. I'll invite Betty Merrill, Dr. Stephen Grover, and Marion Haynes for at the same time. Given that we have a pretty packed agenda, I'm going to be calling people up all at the same time so we can try to be as efficient as possible. I think if I have it right, Ms. Merrill, you're going to start us off. Is that the plan? Excellent.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Betty Merrill. I'm the Assistant Director for the Oregon Department of Energy Conservation Division, and we administer the tax credit programs. I'm going to try and give you a brief history of the business energy tax credit. It was established in 1979 by the Oregon Legislature in reaction to the energy crisis of the 70s. The credit was created as an incentive for Oregon businesses to invest in energy efficiency, renewable energy resources, recycling, and less polluting transportation fuels. The Oregon Department of Energy certifies projects and administers the tax credit program. Today, the tax credit program for conservation and energy efficiency projects is 35% of the eligible project costs qualifying projects. Projects must be at least 10% more energy efficient than energy code or best practices. Qualifying projects must also have a simple payback of 1 to 15 years. In January of 2007, renewable energy projects became eligible for a 50% tax credit, as well as a new class of projects called manufacturing renewable resource projects. Those also became eligible for 50% tax credit. The tax credit program is an incentive, not a reward. Applicants must apply before they commit to a project, before they've signed contracts, before they've purchased equipment. Upon project completion, the business files for a final certificate and if approved, receives their tax credit certificate. A business that receives a tax credit certificate for a conservation or energy efficient project would receive a tax credit for 35% of the eligible cost taken over 5 years, 10% in years 1 and 2, 5% in years 3, 4, and 5. A business that receives a final tax certificate for a 50% credit receives 10% credit each year for 5 years. If the final project cost is less than $20,000, the tax credit can be taken in 1 year. Final certificates are only issued when a project is completed and operational. ODOE has a field inspection process. We go out into the field, check the projects, ensure that they are in compliance with what was proposed before they are issued a final tax credit certificate. An option that went through in 2001 with the Oregon State Legislature was the pass-through option. And what the pass-through option does is it allows nonprofit and public entities with eligible projects but no tax liability to partner with someone who has tax liability to take their tax credit. The rate of transfer is established by the Oregon Department of Energy annually. And how it works is somebody finishes a project, they come in, we complete it, we say they're eligible for a final certificate, and we call it matchmaking. We have someone on staff who actually works with folks from CPA firms or large banks who want to partner with these projects. And we match them up, and the tax credit pass-through partner pays the project owner the net present value for the tax credit. The pass-through program is particularly important for new businesses who have no tax liability. So often a newly established business isn't going to have a tax liability for several years, so the tax credit doesn't serve as a bona fide incentive for them. But with the pass-through partner, a new business can monetize their tax credit and apply the cash payment to their energy project. Applicants for our renewable energy resource equipment manufacturing facilities have another step that other applicants do not. Prior to signing, issuing the preliminary certification, these companies are required to sign a negotiated performance contract, which includes performance measures, a timeline, critical milestones, numbers of employees, salary ranges, quantity and grades of materials produced. It also includes reporting requirements. The Oregon Department of Economic Development and the Oregon Department of Energy work together to do a third-party independent evaluation and due diligence of these companies to make sure that they will be solvent firms and an addition to the Oregon economy. The performance contract for these projects also includes a clawback provision, which allows the state to recover the entire tax credit if the manufacturing facility closes before the 5 years. So, in summary, since 1980, the Oregon Department of Energy has received more than 25,000 business energy tax credit applications and has issued over 16,000 final tax credits. These projects cost approximately $1.6 billion. The energy projects saved or produced 57.2 billion BTUs, or the equivalent of 730,000 homes, the energy used in 730,000 homes. And the business energy tax program is also saving the state, helping the state to meet the reduction in CO2 goals. We've reduced 4.06 million tons of carbon. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Realizing that the focus generally on our hearing today is on the economic development side of the bets here, are there any questions of Ms. Merrill? Representative Holby?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Betty, I didn't hear you exactly. When, over what time period were those tax credits you were mentioning, the 16,000 tax credits?
Since 1980.
Since 1980, and what was the dollar amount of those tax credits?
About $600 million.
$600 million? Thank you.
Did you have a further comment about that?
Yeah, Chair Reed, Representative Polby. I did provide copies of the Echo Northwest report, economic impact report, for the committee.
Oh, great, thanks.
And we'll be talking about that in much greater detail. It's a perfect segue. Dr. Grover?
Thank you. Is my PowerPoint on? My name is Steve Grover from Echo Northwest. And I'll be talking about my report here as soon as...
Looks like we can see it on the screen here, maybe. But you have control over that?
Yeah, I'm not sure if the file was loaded on the computer or not. So
okay.
Is it on here? Maybe I can give a little background while we're...
Sure, please.
Apologize. We were asked by the Department of Energy to conduct an economic impact analysis of the BETSI program from the program years 2007 and 2008. Generally, what we did was we took the data from ODO, so we took their information regarding the number of projects, the project descriptions, the amount of the tax credits for both the residential energy tax credit and the BETSI program, the amount of the dollar savings, and the timing of the projects. We use that as input into our economic impact model. And we ran this separately for the BETSI program and for the RETSI program, which I'll talk about. What I'll do is give a very brief overview of our analysis, which is in more detail of the report, which I believe was sent out. This is... Thank you. Okay, so I know the time is short, so let me just kind of like start again with the overview. We took the data from the Department of Energy. We made several adjustments to it before we ran our model. One was we made what's referred to as a free ridership adjustment, which is a correction to take into account the fact that some of these some of the participants would have likely done these installations anyway, and so we reduced the overall participation by 20% right off the top. There's a fair number of studies out there that have different free ridership rates for different types of equipment, different types of customers. We just took a blanket adjustment of 20%, which we thought was conservative. Incremental equipment costs. We also adjusted the equipment costs down by 50% as well to take into account, from an economic impact standpoint, what's important is just that additional cost over and above what might have been purchased if they had gone with the standard efficiency. So we didn't want to overstate the economic impacts. So again, we just did a blanket adjustment of 50% down for the cost adjustment. Then we also went through each type of equipment and we allocated the total project cost into a component for labor. Basically, what are you paying to have the equipment installed versus the actual equipment itself? And we had some information on this from Energy Trust for a bunch of their measures that we've done a similar analysis for. So we use those to adjust the cost elements that way. And you can imagine for some things like, you know, installing insulation, that's very labor intensive, so you can have a higher labor component versus if you were to put in a compact fluorescent light bulb. That's something you basically just purchase outside, and there's no labor involved. And this is important for our model because we want to make sure that we allocate these costs correctly. Just to give you just a quick overview of the magnitude of some of the numbers we were working with for the residential component, the equipment costs were roughly $70 million a year. The energy cost savings, we also looked at generation, if it was a renewable project, in our model, savings and generation were treated the same, $2.5 million for each year. And the tax credit amount, the amount that was actually given for all these projects, was about $12.5 million each year. And the types of projects, really quickly, so on the residential side, primarily was appliances and hybrid or alternative fuel vehicles. This chart's a little different from what's in the report. This reflects the share of RETC dollars, and the report graph has just the number of projects. So this is a slightly different take on that. And you can see this is fairly consistent across years on the residential side. On the business side, the BETC component, the same adjustments were made. We had a free ridership adjustment. We did the incremental cost adjustment. I should say the incremental cost adjustment was made actually just for the efficiency projects, not for renewable energy projects. So the equipment cost components, 2007 were $126 million. 2008, obviously this gone up quite a bit, up to almost $620 million. And this is due primarily to several large wind projects and other renewable energy projects that really boosted spending that year. Energy savings and generation were $100 million in 2007 and $191 in 2008. And the tax credit amounts have gone up significantly, about three times as much in 2008. I should mention that 2008, all the 2008 numbers that we had to work with were through October of that year, so it's a slightly truncated month or year. This reflects more or less what I was just saying, that the split between renewables and conservation projects the renewables, you can see the orange went from about a third to roughly two-thirds from 07 to 08. And again, this is the share of the Betsy dollars, and it's reflecting the emergence of some very large renewable projects and wind projects in 2008. And this is a little more detail on the types of projects. Okay, so let me explain what we did with this data. You can think about, for the economic impact analysis, every dollar in a community gets spent several times. If you're going to install some equipment, you hire a contractor, that contractor turns around, rents equipment, and purchases their own equipment, and the same dollar is going to circulate several times in the economy. And what we want to do is understand these multiplier effects of the spending. And so what we've done is we've taken the Betsy data, both the tax credit information, the energy cost savings information, and the information about what type of equipment was purchased, and we use that in an input-output model called IMPLAN. And IMPLAN is very detailed. There's over 500 sectors that you can allocate these costs to. And so we went through all the Betsy data and the RETSI data and allocated it based on the industry and the type of equipment that was being purchased. And when we ran this model, we incorporated the spending on the equipment. So if you're a contractor, there's this influx of spending. But then it also counts as a cost to households and businesses now that they have less money to spend because now they're spending it on this equipment. Another component of this was those people that do invest in energy efficiency, now they have the benefit of energy savings. So there's a benefit to their household budget or the business can produce more because now they have more efficient equipment that saves energy. And again, we've also did this allocation between costs, between equipment and labor. In particular with equipment, a lot of the equipment, if not all of it, is pretty much all manufactured outside of the state. And so we wanted to make sure that that was accurately reflected in the model. We don't want to give the appearance of a lot of economic benefits if this stuff is basically being shipped in from elsewhere. And that's particularly true with renewables, the big wind projects. The vast majority of that is on equipment that is manufactured elsewhere. Another important component of the analysis is that we reflect everything in net benefits, where we took a counterfactual base case scenario where instead of having money on the tax credits available, all that money was returned to the government, Oregon government, and spent in other government programs. And so we looked at the economic impacts of that scenario where the millions of dollars of Betsy money is instead spent on other programs, looked at the job impacts, and subtracted those away from the Betsy program. So the numbers here reflect the incremental benefit over and above what would have happened if the Betsy program didn't exist and this money was used somewhere else. Okay, really quickly, RETSI. Once we've done that, here are the economic impacts for 07 and 08, and I realize I'm flying through this, but it's all laid out in great detail in the report. Again, the first row just is a reminder of how much the tax credit amounts totaled each year. This, again, this is the residential component. This resulted in roughly about $36 million of economic output to the state in those years. And so this is the value of the goods and services produced. Wage income went up a little over $3 million. This economic activity generated a little over $3 million in new tax revenue for the state and local jurisdictions and created a little over 100 jobs each year. And again, this is over and above the base case scenario where those funds were used on other government programs. The Betsy numbers naturally are quite a bit larger. The first row, again, payments are significantly greater, and they're three times as great in 08. Economic output, you can see the numbers there, $150 million up to about $350 million in 2008. And about 700, almost 800 jobs in 2007. And in 2008, there's a little over 700 jobs created through October. So significant employment impacts here as well. One thing that I wanted to emphasize, I think it's an important component of this, is the fact that there's a temporal component to these benefits, that there's in one sense, there's the actual installation costs. Those end quickly or end at the time the spending is done for the installation. But the benefits of energy cost savings persist over time, that you may have the Betsy in 08 install your equipment, but you're getting energy cost savings in 09, 010, 11 each year for the life of the useful life of the equipment. And most of the equipment that we're talking about in these programs has a useful life of 10 years or more. And so if you can imagine these benefits being sustained over time and think about the fact that the Betsy has been funded every year since 1980, this has a significant cumulative effect over time. And this is discussed, as I said, in more detail, but I have an example here of the jobs. We've looked at just from the energy savings component, so not the spending component, but for the energy cost savings, what is the benefit of that for different program years. We had done an earlier report for 2006. The energy cost savings benefit of the Betsy at that time was 889 jobs. This is going to vary from year to year depending on the magnitude of the spending and the types of measures that are the Betsy is spent on. So it's going to vary each year. 2007, the cost component was just 1,320, and 2008 so far was 1,603. If you average last 3 years, you get 1,271. So just to conclude graphically, you can see these are the same numbers just shown kind of to illustrate the cumulative effect. You have 889 jobs that are carried forward from 2006 due to energy cost savings. You can see that in 2007, that green component. In 2007, the Betsy program, it's a whole new group of customers. There we have 1,320 jobs, roughly, added that year. The combination of that is 2209. That's carried over to 2008. Then we add another 1,603 in 2008. And then if we assume that if the Betsy program were to be funded and the effects were roughly the average of the last 3 years, which was 1,271, if it continues to be funded each year, then you can see how this just kind of grows over time relative to the case where these investments aren't made. So we can talk, the economy's changing and markets adapt, and you know, these numbers are just rough estimates, really kind of an illustrative method, but definitely it's a component worth thinking about, that these investments do sustain over time. And that concludes my presentation. I'd be happy to answer questions.
Thank you. I'm impressed that you did that with such speed and brevity. Well done. We have a few minutes for questions on the study. No questions? Representative Holby.
Well, I'll venture out there with a question for you. That last chart, you had the cumulative effect of jobs. Mm-hmm. You know, it kind of shows it just going off. Would you expect that trend would continue, I guess? For how long?
Well, as I said, the markets will shift over time. It's important for the Betsy to continually be incenting kind of the cutting edge energy efficiency. That you don't want to be, T8 lights are kind of the efficiency now for office buildings. 10 years from now, you don't want to keep paying for things that basically people would be doing on their own. So if the tax credit program were able to kind of continually adjust to make sure that they're cutting edge, then I would expect these to persist indefinitely. But it's important to keep up with not to be behind the curve.
Suggesting that's a role for the legislature to keep the definitions appropriate and timely.
For Betty, yeah.
Very good. Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Dr. Grover. Following up on Representative Holvey's question, to the extent that the mix of inputs in whatever the current technology is for efficiency or renewable energy changes over time, if Oregon becomes more specialized in producing some of those technologies here, will that change the numbers over time, and if so, in what direction?
Well, generally, if the more of the equipment component is manufactured in-state, the greater the local economic benefit is going to be. So right now, if you, take your typical wind project, 85% of those costs, it may be a $200 million project, but 85% of those costs are going for equipment made outside of the state. To the extent that, we're able to bring that in within the state or with solar, you know, anything that, can be done that, can keep those dollars within the state would increase the, benefit.
Well, Mr. Chair, please. And would it is there any kind of feedback between the, program that exists and the change in that makeup of the different technologies that are used and whether or not they're manufactured here in Oregon?
That I have not examined. I don't know. I would assume so, but I don't know. I haven't looked at it.
But the, if that's not incorporated into this analysis, is
it correct? Is not in this analysis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Grover, in the beginning, you when you were talking about the free ridership in your methodology, and you, said 20% was conservative. And how do you mean conservative? Do, you mean it, that's assuming more, perhaps, than it would be, or conservative
I would,
in what way?
I would say that, it's probably on too high of a reduction. That the number might, be lower.
Number might
like
be 10% lower.
10% or 5%. It varies quite a bit depending on the type of technology. The more cutting edge you are, as far as, you know, if you think about maybe lighting, if you're familiar with that, where T8s are kind of the norm, T5s are more expensive, and then LEDs are extremely expensive. So you'd expect more people maybe might do T8s on their own. But LEDs, there'd be very few people that are willing to spend, you know, 10 times as much for an LED without some assistance. So, but that's a whole separate type of analysis that we weren't able to get into. That typically with energy efficiency programs, when they evaluate them, they spend quite a bit of time trying to determine free ridership, and that's was really kind of outside the scope. So we wanted to take one number and, make some sort of adjustment and, feel that at least that phenomenon is being accounted for.
Thanks. Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Grober, maybe you can share with me a little more clarity on your last slide where it talks about the energy cost savings, sustaining jobs. And is the assumption there that the money that you don't have to spend on energy, you thus will spend on hiring more people? Can you share with me what exactly you meant by that?
Basically, there's households have more money to spend, and so there's a boon to the economy that way. But then also, businesses in general are able to produce more. Their costs have gone down, and so we're assuming that that has a one-to-one relationship on what they're being able to produce. That may mean hiring more people, or it may mean purchasing more equipment to expand capacity.
Please, in a down market like we are currently suffering through a down employment market, does that affect your assumptions in this last slide?
No, this doesn't take. This is a, static model, so it doesn't take into account basically, you know, capital constraints or the types of you know what businesses have the flexibility to make these types of investments now. But one thing this does suggest is that, you know, investments in earlier years have, you know, we're enjoying the benefits now of these investments made in prior years, and so it helps not be reactive to bad economies, but it helps kind of smooth things out to some degree to you know, make businesses more efficient and able to compete in a down market. But this is, but what's one thing I should mention, the implant is a static model. Again, this is to show the trend. I wouldn't want to show this out for 20 years with exact numbers like this. I mean, the trend is certainly there, but over time, as you know, this assumes the same technologies in 2006 as in 2011, the same basic mix of companies in the state. And so, you know, I think again that this sustainability, the sustaining of this benefit is certainly there, but the mix over time is going to change.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you very much. Ms. Haynes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Reed, committee members. My name is Maureen Haynes. I'm with the Oregon Business Association. OBC believes the Betsy credit is an important and successful tool for the state. It combines two goals, economic development and encouraging increased sustainability. I realize that we're focused here on economic development, and I would suggest that those two, in this case, aren't mutually exclusive. This is a first-in-the-kind in the nation credit, and now we see that other states are looking to emulate this program based on our success. We think there's really three reasons that this credit has and will continue to be a benefit to the state. First, it has brought tremendous economic development opportunities, diversifying Oregon's economy, creating jobs, and positioning Oregon as a leader in green industries. We've heard about that from Steve, and I know you have other panel members that can speak to that directly. Second, as we've also heard, it does help Oregon to reach its greenhouse gas reduction goals. And I do think there's an economic development component here as well. When we think about a more comprehensive carbon reduction strategy, whether it's cap and trade or some alternative, whether it's at the regional or at the federal level, increased investment in energy and fuel efficiency is going to be critical to that. This credit has shown itself to be able to drive those kinds of investments. And it really can assist preparing businesses and residences to deal with a carbon-constrained economy. To the extent there will be a cap or something else like that on businesses, we know that there will be winners and losers in that situation. And so having an incentive to help businesses take the steps they need to deal in that kind of environment is going to be critical to helping them remain competitive. Third, with the priorities of the Obama administration and aimed at renewable energy and clean technologies, we've positioned ourselves as an early leader in this arena and think we can really leverage some of the policies and money that we see coming out of the federal government in this arena. So as we've heard from at the Northwest report, the Betsy credit has provided dividends to the state both in an economic and environmental respect. Nationwide, Oregon has established itself a distinct niche in renewable energy and green building at a time when federal policies look to align in this direction and other states are looking to follow our lead. We need to keep pushing forward with this tool. It's been a real boom for the state.
Thank you. Are there questions? Just one quick one for you. What's been your experience, if any, with inquiries from other states, or you mentioned that about other states that may be seeking to emulate? Is that going to be a source of competitive advantage for Oregon that's at risk now, or?
Well, I think that as others look to do something similar, I mean, we've already established ourselves with this credit, so that does give us a leg up, but it does mean that there will be more competition out there, others that are looking to provide incentives to do the kinds of things that we've really been able to capture here early and more than other states have at this point.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions, well, thank you all for your testimony and for coming. Next on our list, Bob Beisner, Vernon Edwards, and Desiree Strader. Please. Missing Mr. Edwards, huh? Please go ahead.
Good afternoon, Chair Reed and committee members. My name is Desiree Strader. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Solar Energy Industries Association. I have a few numbers to start off with here. Out of the 1,700 jobs created in 2007-08, nearly two-thirds of those jobs were represented in the solar industry. We represent currently now in the solar industry nearly 5% of the personal income tax to the state of Oregon. Using the Eco Northwest multiplier of 2.4% as used in high tech and the semiconductor industry, we are now nearly 15% of the state income tax. We are on pace to recruit 5 to 6 new companies that will locate here in Oregon and develop in 2009 with nearly, over the next 2 year projected, nearly 3,500 jobs in the solar industry. I think it was a past president that said it's the economy stupid. I think today it's the job stupid. This year will be a defining moment for this state, our nation, and for my generation. I am very proud of how far our generation has come. While much has been written in the past about a generation disengaged from the mainstream political and social institution, the reality is we have matured and risen to lead our industries, our communities, hold elected office, and we have created a global network of activism and information sharing that has led a political and economic revolution. One of our greatest opportunities in building a real sustainable statewide economy is renewable energy and lead the nation becoming energy independent. Oregon is rich in natural resources, which also holds great prospect for renewable energy, with wind energy in the gorge, eastern Oregon, wave energy on the coast, geothermal energy in southern Oregon, and solar energy throughout the state of Oregon. As Governor Ted Kulongowski has already demonstrated his commitment to building Oregon's future and renewable energy economy, as he addressed the 75th Legislative Assembly, he said, "There is a green revolution stirring in America, and Oregon is the beating heart of that revolution." And he was right. He also went on to say that this state will lead the nation in being the largest solar manufacturing cluster in the nation, and I believe that to be true. One of the most critical tools in building this foundation of our renewable energy economy has been the Business Energy Tax Credit, otherwise known as the BETC. The BETC has proven its value already, serving as a critical component in the recruitment of high-paying, family-wage jobs across the state. Solar manufacturers have already chosen to locate in Deschutes, Marion, Multnomah, Klamath, and Washington counties, with the average job in solar manufacturing $90,000 annually, well above the state manufacturing average of $39,000. Solar research and development jobs are growing exponentially annually. As the solar industry is growing, companies are hiring, and the industry is already contributing, as I said, 5% of Oregon's overall personal income tax revenue. As we look out and see, the increased development of solar manufacturers today has also produced hundreds of jobs in the construction industry and through their relationship with hundreds of local suppliers and vendors. In a dark time of economic times, solar is the beacon of light for this state, and the BETC is our most competitive and effective tool in growing the solar industry. The solar BETC, as I like to say, is the traded sector jobs creation tool, and it is vital as we continue to bring jobs to the state, that we have this tool that has been very effective for the solar industry. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Mr. Beisner.
Hello, my name is Bob Beisner. I'm a vice president with Solar World. I'd like to tell you a little bit about the story of Solar World and why we came to Oregon. About 2 years ago, we were out looking for a new site. We needed this so we could, in fact, increase our productivity. Our overriding goal as a company is to continue to decrease the cost of solar energy so ultimately we'll be competitive with an average utility, that you could go ahead and put your solar array up and compete with the utility. This is the goal of the solar industry. In doing so, we were given a number of opportunities as to places to locate. There were places overseas. There were states here in the United States, California, where we were currently located. Our major operation was in California. The state of Washington looked at us. Alabama. It seemed the more our reputation got around, the more people looked at us. And ultimately, despite the fact that the state has a wonderful employment base, the programs that have been put in place through the semiconductor industry gives us an excellent workforce, that we have vendors who are able to support our industry as well as the semiconductor industry. The overriding factor in making our ultimate decision to come here was the BETC, that this is what made the deal possible for us. We debated, why would we come here? Why would we not go and have our expansion in Germany? Why would we not have our expansion in one of these other states? And we said, the BETC's put us over the top. So I must tell you how important the BETC's were to us in our decision-making process. Now, that being said, we also know that we have to deliver on this. And so when Mr. Klebensberger and I were down here last year, we talked about what we were going to do that we were going to take 500,000 square feet, and we were going to fill it up with solar equipment, and we were going to become the largest cell manufacturer in the United States. We've done that. We produce 100 megawatts of cells from our facility, and this employs 461 Oregonians. When we initially took over that plant, it was sitting at idle. There were less than 10 people at that plant. And this is the type of economic growth that the Betsys have allowed to come to Oregon, and is one of the major reasons why we would look for future expansions in the state of Oregon. So again, I think we'd be happy to answer any questions on this subject.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? Representative Holby.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I really appreciate you being here and testifying on this subject. The Betsy, of course, is obviously important to you and to us. I'm curious, and just in talking about solar in general, we oftentimes look at the kilowatt cost per hour and compare that to hydro or wind or something else. And you know, when we're in this committee, we started out with a presentation on economics 101, which talked about some different economic values that we don't always consider. And in relationship to kilowatt hours, we don't necessarily consider the cost that it would have taken for other forms of electric generation, such as transmission, that solar oftentimes doesn't have a great need for new transmission lines because it can be on the very building that you're sitting in, and so you don't have to transmit it from the hills of wind or the river where the dam is. So I'm wondering, do you have or does anybody have figures on those sorts of cost savings that we fit into an economic model and trying to figure out the long-term sustainable economic value of solar as opposed to other forms of energy?
You want to take that?
I kind of know the urban legend on this.
Yes.
So the general point of view, and again, my apologies to any of my colleagues from the utility industries who are here, but the general point of view is about one-third of the transmission. It takes about a third of the energy produced just to push the electrons in the grid. And so you're correct that the distributed generation philosophy of solar works quite well, particularly with the Obama administration's goal of what they're trying to do: come up with a smart grid, improve the grid efficiency. But right now, solar could go ahead and provide that that efficiency that you spoke so eloquently about.
Representative Benz.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for being here today. I feel kind of like a stockholder in your corporation because of these tax credit investment, and I'm curious
as well. You should.
Yes, exactly. So I'm curious about a couple of things. But first of all, how much of a tax credit do you folks utilize? And secondly, are there suggestions you could make to us about how we might more efficiently invest in a company such as yours?
Okay. We've received one tax credit. It was approximately $7 million, and that was a part of the pass-through credit that we had received. This was for the initial purchase of the land and our initial investment and some upgrades to the facility to really take it from a semiconductor operation to a solar operation. So that's the initial investment that the state has made in our facility. The way in which we would hope to act in the future is to be this good corporate citizen, that we know that we have to go ahead, work with the state in regard to solar programs that it wants to accomplish. We think that through our manufacturing efforts, we'll go ahead and be able to have the types of programs that just wouldn't be available to other states because of the fact that we're located here. So this would be the reciprocal arrangement that we think should exist between the private sector and the public sector.
Well, please. Thank you for that. To go back, though, to the you used a pass-through partner.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So were you happy with the efficiency of that tool, or do you think we could do a better job getting you more money out of that of that tax credit? Because I think it cost us a full dollar, and I just want to know if you were happy with how much you got.
Is this where the chair objects to leading the witness?
Oh, I'm sorry.
And as you notice, he looked at me to say, can I answer?
Please go ahead.
First of all, I wanted to compliment the Department of Energy and their efficiency in the way in which they handled this. It was truly amazing, and I know the staffing constraints that they were under at the time, so the manner in which it was handled was top-notch. And we know that we have to make an economic decision, and it's really kind of boils down to what's the cash flow on this. And we are not going to pretend to try and influence the public policy that needs to go on. But this is a decision that the state needs to make, and we're happy to live with that decision. We may come and testify, and we may have a point of view, but ultimately that needs to be the decision within the rulemaking body. So it was very attractive to us to have that type of pass-through arrangement. It worked quite well, and there would be no complaints from Solar World on this.
There have been proposals, I think, that are beginning to make their way through the process around allowing that pass-through to go to multiple partners. Would that have an effect for you, or would you support that sort of a notion?
Yes, and if that were to go forward, excuse me, let me look if I could answer that question.
Yes, you can.
The reason we think that would be very important is it's sometimes very difficult to find somebody with a large tax appetite. So to have it chopped up and to have it more
digestible,
have it administered more easily really is important. And I think that those administrative rules could use some help right now. Maybe there just needs to be a little closer cooperation between a couple of the different regulatory agencies within the state that would make it much more effective.
I expect we might see you on Thursday in the Revenue Committee.
I think I'm there.
Very good. Representative Holby?
One final question. I know that your industry and your company specifically have made a commitment to Oregon, and I'm just curious, as we look at public policy, we have developed policies around using solar technologies on public buildings, and you know there's some in this building that think that perhaps that's not, it shouldn't be so specific to solar, and so that concerns me a little bit. I'm just kind of curious, maybe it's a loaded question, but just sort of curious what your take on the state's commitment to use solar on public buildings is.
Can I take this?
Yes, please.
Well, I would say this. I think that I would not be surprised if we see the White House in the next year or so powered by solar. So I think if it's good enough for the White House, I think it should be good enough for Oregon public buildings.
Representative Bailey?
Mr. Chair, in the interest of time, I'll skip my question.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate you being here.
Sure.
I hope I'm pronouncing the next person correctly. Chris Hassel.
Excuse me.
Is that right? And Jack Hisselman is coming as well. And I'm sorry. I skipped ahead. I'm sorry. I was thinking we were further ahead. Valerie Franklin from Horizon Wind and Margie Hoffman from Iberdrola. You guys are on deck. Sorry about that.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today. My name is Valerie Franklin. I'm a project manager with Horizon Wind Energy. I work in development of new wind power projects, more specifically in Eastern Oregon in the Union County area. Horizon Wind Energy is actually the third largest wind energy developer, owner, and operator in the country. And in Oregon, we've built about 300 megawatts of wind power projects. My experience is more in Union County, where I can talk a little bit about the Elkhorn Valley Wind Power Project, where we installed a 100-megawatt project, creating about 250 construction jobs in 2007, and generated about $13 million in local spending. To develop a wind power project, you really need to make five things happen. wind, land, transmission, getting a permit, and a power purchase agreement with the utility. If any one of those buckets falters, then you lose a little bit of your competitive edge. And with the Betsy, that has really helped us to maintain our competitive edge, specifically internally for me with other projects around the country. On the back of my testimony are two graphics. The top one shows where Oregon ranks in terms of wind capacity and wind potential. I find it really interesting that Oregon is ranked 7th in terms of actually installed wind power projects, but 23rd in terms of wind power potential. I think a big reason that we're so high up on that list for installed wind power projects when we don't have the same wind that other states do is because of these policies. So the Betsy really makes up for that loss of wind power that we have in a state. There's a story I can tell where we had a project in Washington that was ready to go. It had a permit, it had wind, it had land, but the transmission faltered, and so the turbines got sent to Illinois. And not to say that there are never going to be any more projects in Oregon if the Betsy were to falter, but it really does give us that competitive edge. The competition is increasing, too, in the future, I think especially with the new administration's policies and specifically with some of the new transmission lines that are designed to funnel wind energy from windier states like Wyoming out to Oregon. That competitiveness is going to be increasing. As some of the other folks have already said earlier, Oregon has really distinguished itself and come ahead leading the pack. If they were on a highway and Oregon's already got its pedal to the metal, if it falters up right now, I think that other states will come and try to pass us. So with that, I just urge you to consider keeping the Betsy. For large wind, you know, we are one of, although we are a larger company, we're not immune to the economy and what's going on. You know, although we can be a bright star in the new economy, I think the Betsy will help keep these wind projects in Oregon. And I'd be happy to answer any questions as well.
Thank you. I can hear from Ms. Hoffman first.
Hi. For the record, my name is Margie Hoffman, and I'm here on behalf of Iberdrola Renewables Incorporated, and thank you very much for allowing me the time to testify today. I'm going to go over, I submitted written testimony. I'm going to briefly touch on a couple of points and hopefully not repeat, but Iberdrola Renewables is America's second largest developer of operator of wind energy in the U.S. The company is headquartered in Portland, Oregon, with 300 employees in the state of Oregon alone. Iberdrola and its predecessor company, PPM, have invested approximately $1 billion in wind power generation facilities in Oregon. We list some of the projects that we have here, but I want to say that Oregon accounts for about 30% of Iberdrola Renewables' U.S. wind energy portfolio. As my colleague stated, there are a number of reasons that Oregon is competitive with wind. And the reason that companies like ours continue to invest in projects in Oregon is mostly due to the state's strong commitment to diversifying its renewable energy portfolio and investing in renewable energy in Oregon. I just want to highlight what this return on investment means for the state of Oregon. I think it's really important, as was laid out in the Eco Northwest study, not just to focus on the number that we're paying out, but what we're getting back from that dollar that we spend. We get back $3 for every one that we invest, roughly. In addition to that, we get hundreds of well-paying construction jobs for each project that bolster the state's income tax revenues. We get permanent operations and maintenance jobs. We get significant tax payments to county government with few services required. And I think it's really important that as we see the county payments in decline, this is really a vital revenue source for rural communities around the state. We get rental payments to private landowners of several thousand dollars per turbine per year. Per turbine, they get about $7,000 to $14,000 as they lease spaces on their land. I grew up on a small ranch in Colorado. I've seen what it means when Californians, no offense to the Californians in the room, but we didn't have a wind resource. And the ranches that surround the ranch and I grew up on didn't have a way to generate revenue as the agricultural industry continued on the decline. And so this is something that's really key to Oregon that helps us preserve some of our rural way of life, the ranches and the farms that we have here and that we're lucky to have here. There are ancillary economic benefits to local businesses, and there are also white-collar management jobs at our Oregon headquarters. So again, I cannot emphasize enough when projects compete internally at Iberdrola, one of the big reasons that we continue to invest in Oregon is because of the Betsy, even though Oregon isn't the best wind resource available. We could be doing business in Wyoming, South Dakota, et cetera, but we like to work here. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you both. Ms. Franklin and Margie for being here. Margie, I did not realize you had grown up in Colorado. Do you have a visa to be?
Actually, Chair Reed, Representative Gilliam, it's funny that you asked because they didn't check my passport at the border.
Okay, fine. Well, we're glad you're here. And I just had a quick question.
Is that a follow-up?
Yeah, you asked your question.
Please go ahead.
He's used to my committee.
Exactly. I have free reign. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
No, please go ahead.
Thank you. Just a quick question. Obviously, Betsy is important to your business, or you wouldn't be here. But I also just wanted to ask you another aspect of your business in wind. If you had a way to, because we all know those things turn when they want to turn, not necessarily when we want them to turn. If you had a way to safely store that and cleanly burn it, and even out your whole grid, what would you say to that? Would that be something you'd be interested in?
That is something that's being explored. It's called pump storage, where it's pumped down below the ground, and then the gas is then let out, which then turns a turbine.
Oh, this is different.
It's the new technology that's, I think, on the horizon, but not quite ready yet.
Good. Follow up,
please.
And I'm interested to hear about that, but I hope you'll stay for our last presenter today. Please stay in the room because I think there's great implications for your industry. Thank you.
I think, Representative Gilliam, you're perhaps channeling your other career, too, doing a little tease for the end of the hearing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Your testimony.
You.
Now, we're ready. As I prematurely mentioned earlier, Chris Hassel and Jack Hisselman and Tucker Roberti, please.
Chair Reed, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman of Tonkin Torp. I'm joined today by Chris Hassel to my immediate right. Chris is a senior vice president with United Fund Advisors, an investment fund based in Portland that specializes in social and environmental transactions nationwide and has utilized the business energy tax credit in innovative transactions in Oregon. In particular, Chris is here today to speak with you regarding United Fund Advisors' role in the development of Oregon's iconic solar highway project. This was a collaboration among several great Oregon enterprises, including United Fund Advisors, Portland General Electric, and Solar World. So with that, I'll turn it over to Chris.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for inviting me. As Jack said, United Fund Advisors, we're a triple bottom line investment firm. We make investments in social and environmental deals here in Oregon and around the U.S. All of our projects are tax credit driven, whether it be federal or state investments. So what we do behind the scenes is we structure these transactions and then sell the tax credits that are available on the transactions to primarily national banks and insurance companies. And the business energy tax credit here in Oregon has attracted many of our national investors who have a footprint here in the state to come in and do transactions. And we do a lot of work with new market tax credits, which provide social development here in the state. But we also are now heavily involved in the investment tax credit from a federal standpoint, which couples quite well with the business energy tax credit. Because of the availability of the business energy tax credit here in the state, we were able to get our feet wet in renewable energy last year, and we were able to do our first three solar projects here in the state, one of which was the Oregon Solar Highway Project. And that was a relatively small transaction, and typically our investors wouldn't be attracted to a project of that size. But it was an important project for the state, and it was there were good partners involved in it, and the banks were therefore interested in doing it. We also did two other larger size projects here in the state. And if it had not been for the business energy tax credit, the deals wouldn't have been financed. There wouldn't have been sufficient benefits available to third-party investors to come in and do these sorts of deals. I guess I should clarify that all the transactions we're looking at are project finance. To date, they've only been in solar. We're starting to look at wind deals, and they're third-party finance. These aren't owner-occupied projects. The availability of the Betsy is what has attracted these outside investors who do have a footprint here in Oregon to take advantage of it. The Solar Highway project was an interesting project for us. Once again, it was relatively small, but from an economic standpoint, the Betsy is what pushed it over the top. And that was the same for the other two projects that we did here in the state. As everybody's reading the papers, we all know that tax equity is drying up, so that is one of the issues that we're looking at for financing these larger projects. It's getting more and more difficult to find banks that have the appetite here in Oregon and have the interest in financing projects at this point with the available tax equity that they have. Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You'll have to express or describe for me tax equity because I'm not following.
I'm sorry. So the investors that we work with, the national banks, their goal is to purely purchase the tax credits available on these transactions. So they're what we call a strip investor, and they're not necessarily interested in owning the underlying asset from an operation standpoint or a long-term holding aspect. What they're interested is providing equity to own these projects and in turn receive purely the tax benefits of the transaction. So they receive the business energy tax credit, the federal tax credits, and then the associated depreciation and loss benefits for owning it. So their tax equity comes into the project.
So from your standpoint, are we going to see, or are we already seeing, a dramatic decline in the people that want these types of projects? Is that what you're seeing from your vantage point?
There's definitely a contraction in the market from a national standpoint of the investors that are available to come in and purchase state credits. There's also competition for where that tax equity, those dollars will go, whether it's here in Oregon or in another state where there might be a more attractive return. But there are still players out there. Unfortunately, some of the larger banks have carry forward losses that have occurred here in Oregon, and they aren't able to currently participate in the program, but those will fall off after a few years, and they'll be able to get back into the investment arena here.
I can follow up on that a little bit. How do we stand relative to those other states that you mentioned?
We recently did a transaction at the end of last year in Hawaii, and they have a similar tax credit to what we have here, the Hawaii Energy Tax Credit. It's very similar in nature to the way this one is structured. The benefit that Hawaii sees is their electricity rates are extremely higher than what we see here in Oregon. And so those additional benefits, the cash benefits on selling the power in Hawaii, become competitive with Oregon because the electricity rates are so cheap here. So if you can get the same federal tax benefits, the same state tax benefits, but you can get a higher price for the electricity you sell, that makes a program like Hawaii a little more competitive.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Gilliam?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. When you mentioned banks not having an appetite for helping out or loaning, is that more due to what the times we're in or their attitude towards alternative energy?
I would say all the banks that we deal with in some form or another have a renewable energy initiative internally. They're not blind to the investment. They actually care about making these social and environmental investments that we bring to them. I would say that the biggest issue we're experiencing right now is the contraction of the banks that are out there and all the losses they're incurring and their inability to take advantage of a larger tax liability, especially in the state.
One last question. I asked Mr. Beisner about the proposal that has begun around allowing more partners to participate through pass-through. How would that affect your business?
Once again, I want to reiterate that what we've done to date has purely been in the solar arena. We're looking at wind. So examples of other groups who are coming into the state, and either they're taking advantage of the credit themselves for building a site, completely different than the sort of arena that I'm dealing with. The pass-through on these larger solar projects that we're looking at, the economics in the projects we've looked at with the investors we've looked at, the economics haven't been strong enough to take advantage of the pass-through program. So these have all been directly owned by these investors, and we haven't been selling off the credits through the pass-through program. Whether it was multiple investors, though, or one investor, I think it'd be better, you know, the more players you have in the industry.
Thanks. Representative Benson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The power purchase agreements that you referenced in Oregon, is it possible that some of these will be entered into with folks out of California? Aren't PPAs being generated for purchase of power generated in Oregon but sold in California?
We haven't done any projects like that, but I wouldn't be surprised if people are wheeling power down to California from what was produced here.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you.
Thank you.
Next on our list, and last on our list with respect to the Betsy, is Cameron Hamilton, David Furr, and Rich Zielinski. Thank you, guys. You can decide who goes first. They're handing you the microphone.
Yeah, I'm Rich Zielinski, and Cherry, and members of the committee. I'm facility manager for Ross Family Markets, and we're a grocery-based company in Salem, Oregon. And I'm here today to support the business energy tax credit, and I want to share the results of a recent retrofit light grid involving the Energy Trust. And Salem store had a perfectly working light grid, and only one problem: it had old technology and used a tremendous amount of kilowatts. And a recent development in technology developed another bulb that had comparable foot candle power and used 52% less energy. And unfortunately, you know, many businesses will pay marginally higher electric bills rather than incur larger cash outlays to upgrade new technology today. And interest and cash outlay needs to be borrowed. Payback is too many years in the future to switch to new technology. On the second page here, I have a recent project that we did. And under A there shows the 39,464 kilowatts that was saved. And the B shows the upgrade. The technology was $19,250. And C is the estimated annual savings of $2,775. And D is the Energy Trust investment. Without it was 6.9 years. And with the incentive, it was 4.8 years. And the go or not to go decision was to spend the $19,000 was the incentive trust money of $5,920. And since we're in the PGE area, you have to think about the amount of coal that we didn't have to buy at Boardman and save that particular investment of coal and didn't burn for the energy that we saved at the particular facility that we did the upgrade. Just in support of the program, and we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. I really appreciate hearing a concrete example from the rest of the panel, and perhaps have some questions for you. Thanks.
Great. Chairman Reed, committee members, my name is Cameron Hamilton. I work with McKinstry Company. We're based in Portland, Oregon. We're a contracting company. We are in opposition of the House bill, and I would like to tell you a little bit about who we are and why we're in opposition. 7 years ago, McKinstry in Oregon was a one-person organization from our energy group. Today, we are 26 direct employees for our energy group, being part of our contracting group. We had sales in Oregon of under $1 million 7 years ago. We're approximately about $18 million right now. Our group supports our electrical group, our mechanical group, our professional services group, such as engineers within our organization. We are also supporting local and regional distributors, contractors, and professional services companies with the projects that we do. The BETSI is directly attributable to the work that we are doing down here. I'll give you a good example of that. In Enterprise, Oregon, out on the east side, we did a biomass boiler system for the school district out there. The project had a 20-year payback based on the economics. The BETSI gave it a 15-year payback that ultimately got it to a go decision. The big benefit was that not only was the BETSI the kicker to get the project going, but it kept money in the local community. So fuel supply is being developed in the local community there for wood. The boiler was manufactured by an Oregon manufacturing company. The contractors that installed the project were all based in Oregon, and all the professional services were based in Oregon as well. I liken the cap to the BETSI to what happened with the Energy Trust of Oregon probably 4 years ago when they turned their spigot off on their incentive, and it evaporated about $3 million worth of work for us. And it took us about 18 months to recover from that. We were hiring people. We put a hiring freeze in place for almost 18 months. We ultimately recovered from that, and we're back on track again. But unfortunately, it sent a company like ours sideways. I want to reinforce the point that the BETSI is a tremendous program that helps a lot of different individuals out there, be it commercial, industrial, or municipalities, and it would be a shame that if we put a cap on this program that we would be giving a haircut to projects going through. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Furr.
I'm David Furr. I work with Salem Kaiser Public Schools here in Salem. I am the energy manager or utilities coordinator, they call me. My job is to work in the facilities department, as I do, and to find ways to save energy, reduce utility costs, and operate more efficiently. We use the BETSI pass-through program, and I hope to paint a little bit more of a kind of a ground-level view for you on that. We've put in 75 efficiency projects in place since 2001-2002. From those, we reap $176,000 every year in energy savings, which has been very valuable to us, of course. The projects that we've done have improved the quality of the buildings and the classrooms that we have our children in. We have four of our projects were water heating projects. We insulated eight buildings. We put in HVAC and HVAC controls projects in six buildings. We replaced the windows in all or part of five buildings. We have upgraded lighting in 52 of our sites. Most of that project is in upgrading gymnasium lighting, eliminating the metal halide lighting, which SB 479 last year required. The total cost of those projects was about $2.4 million. We got BETSI pass-through money on that to the tune of $495,000. The BETSI comprised 21% of the contribution towards those projects. If we had not received the BETSI contribution, we would have completed that many fewer projects in our buildings. Other districts may have received more or less than ours, but the benefits of the BETSI funds have been crucial for all Oregon schools, for the communities that support them, for the local economies, jobs that those projects support. our projects have poured nearly $3 million in total into our community's economy, due primarily to our preference for using local contractors. Many of our most of our Betsy pass-through partners are citizens supporting Oregon schools. The largest number of them are. They've contributed just over $200,000. Some of those people are from the Salem community. The rest of them are not, so it's bringing extra dollars into our community from outside. Our corporate pass-through partners are, we've used two banks, one of which is a local office of a larger franchise bank, and another is a life insurance company. The total amount that we receive from those businesses is almost $300,000. The Betsy program, the pass-throughs, have allowed us to perpetuate the contribution. We receive funding from our community to make our schools happen, to serve the community. In turn, we're happy with these kinds of projects to further assist the community with the jobs that come from these projects, and the economic contribution goes back to the community, which in turn makes us a more viable partner in the community. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Questions from the committee? I really appreciate you giving us a sense of how this happens on the ground. Thank you guys very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll transition now a little bit. Representative Gilliam's going around to give an introduction. While he's doing that, I think the concluding comment for this, unless others have some thoughts, is just to keep this in mind around our economic development issues. I know we're going to be having some hearings in the Revenue Committee. At least three members of this committee will be there for that. There's lots to talk about in the Betsy, but I wanted to make sure we had a chance to talk about the effect it's having. I appreciate the discussion we've had today. So, Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Vic Gilliam, State Representative from District 18 and a member of the committee. I don't want any of the members to infer that I am now open for questions just because I came down to the panel, but I did want to introduce our guest because I'm so excited about what the role hydrogen might have in our energy future. And those of you that were in the 07 session voted with the entire 60 members of the House on a resolution that we had to highlight and spotlight hydrogen, and now we hope in this session to go a next step. We're not here to discuss that legislation, but rather to give you an overview. Jack and I first met when we were both on the Hatfield staff. Jack was a policy advisor in foreign affairs and energy issues, and I wasn't. But he went on from there to spend about 20 years with the Bonneville Power Administration, where he had a number of roles, including acting director twice. And while he was acting director, he founded the Bonneville Environment Foundation, or Environmental Foundation, I guess it is. And some of you may be familiar with that. And since retiring at the ripe age of 30 or whatever he was, he's also been the co-founder of the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance. And I think you'll enjoy the presentation. I hope we have a little time for questions. So thank you very much for welcoming Jack Roberts.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Vic. My name's Jack Robertson. I'm from Multnomah County in Portland. Let me just quickly give you an idea of what's going on, what we think we've created here, which we're quite excited about. And fundamentally, what I'm going to discuss is a concept known as hydrogen hubs. We've come up with this notion. We think it's a technological breakthrough. And the most important message I want to leave with you today is we think we have created a practical, fundamental new technology which can capture very, very quickly the enormous excess hydropower, wind power of the region, store it and regenerate that power precisely at the center of load for the power grid. So this is a means by which we can capture the excess power of the Columbia River, excess wind power of the region, that is the wind power that blows at night when we're not using it, the power grid doesn't utilize it, capture it, store it, bring that power to the center of cities, and in doing so save
but we think hundreds of millions of dollars for consumers around the region, and taking full advantage of this enormous Saudi Arabia of hydrogen energy that we're sitting on in the Pacific Northwest. So the key question, the key technology, which I'll describe briefly, is and which we're pursuing now very rapidly along with other utilities in the region, is to take off-peak wind power, off-peak solar power, anything, any kind of energy from the hydro system or from any other renewable resource that is not designed to and controlled to meet energy peaks from the power grid, and to reshape them. And the way we do that is we capture the electricity from those renewable energy resources, and we synthesize two fundamentally renewable resources into a hydrogen-dense fuel. The resources we use is the hydrogen found in water, the electricity that comes from wind power and other renewable resources, which is used to crack or split the water into its two component parts, hydrogen gas and oxygen gas. We put the oxygen gas to the side and sell it to hospitals. We take the hydrogen gas and we combine that with molecules from the air, nitrogen from the air. The air is 78% nitrogen. We pull a molecule of nitrogen out of the air. We combine it in a synthesis process with three molecules of hydrogen to create the world's densest hydrogen fuel, which is known to all of us as ammonia. Now, anhydrous ammonia is something that everyone thinks about as a cleaning agent, or perhaps as fertilizer for agriculture in the spring, which is what's placed on the fields for nitrogen density for fertilization of crops. What's interesting, and what the scientists working at the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance, this 501c3 I helped found, has come to the conclusion of, is ammonia is the purest, densest form of hydrogen in the world. It will always be the densest form of hydrogen in the world. Ammonia has 50% more hydrogen energy in it than liquid hydrogen itself, which takes a huge amount of energy to push together, to store, to densify, and then to make practical to use. The problem with using making hydrogen practical has always been you have to put a lot of energy into water or a lot of energy into other systems to create hydrogen and to store it practically in a dense way. Storing it temporarily in ammonia fuel allows us then to take that ammonia and to use it as a fuel source to then generate electricity on peak, precisely where the load is needed at the center of cities, with zero pollution. And the reason is because when you use ammonia as a fuel to generate power, the only byproduct you have is hydrogen, which forms together with oxygen after it generates power to form water vapor, and nitrogen, which is released back into the atmosphere, which absorbs it for reacceptance. So when you start with water and nitrogen from the air and electricity from renewable energy resources, you store it temporarily in hydrogen-dense fuel of ammonia, and you regenerate it precisely where you want to, anytime you want to, because it doesn't pollute. You have a perfect closed environmental loop, but you create and recreate out of renewable energy sources, power sources that can be used precisely when the grid needs them, for the first time ever, in a way that's practical. We can do this better than anybody else because we sit on one of the world's great hydrogen-producing systems known as the Columbia River. We add to that thousands of megawatts of new wind energy that comes in. But the problem is the system of the Columbia River is not controlled. Thousands of megawatts of non-firm hydropower come down every spring, can't be controlled by the dams, is either sold to California for dimes on the dollar or simply wasted as it was this last spring. Thousands of megawatts of wind energy comes in over the top of that and actually aggregates the problem, because it's creating more excess electricity precisely when we don't need it, and the wind energy tends to blow in the spring when there's a lot of temperature inversions. So what we're doing is capturing all that low value but very important renewable energy and reshaping it into periods of time when it's worth 10 times as much. So that's the fundamental notion behind hydrogen hubs. Vic has been very supportive, and so have many members of this committee, to get the attention of this potential to the people of the state. We now want to begin to demonstrate that, so we have a proposal to study in the finish the study in the next 3 months, of engineering and feasibility study, moving toward a demonstration of a 5,000 home hydrogen hub within 1 year. We believe the technology to do this is available to us now. We believe more efficient technology will be available to us within 2 years. And we believe that in doing so, we can create a new method of giving strength and breadth to renewable energy resources, strengthening the power grid, not weakening it, and having a model where we can create a new renewable energy resource that can have a world-class industry in the state and create new jobs as well.
Thank you.
So that's what we're up to.
I imagine we have a few questions for you, but Representative Gilliam, I realize you're still sitting there, so you're making yourself a little more open.
I'm making myself really open.
Ask questions, too. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Holby?
Yeah, I was wondering what position Representative Gilliam had with Hatfield's office. I didn't quite catch that one.
I think it was not.
Oh.
Thank you, Mr.
Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What volume of water does it take?
Well, let me give you an example of how much hydrogen there is in the water of the Columbia River. In the entire remaining oil reserves of Saudi Arabia, I believe, constitute about 500 billion barrels of oil. There is sufficient hydrogen in the water. There's 300,000 cubic feet of water per second that comes down the Columbia River. In 1 second, there's enough hydrogen in the volume of water in the Columbia River to equal the entire remaining oil reserves of Saudi Arabia in 67 days of flow of the Columbia River. And that's every 67 days for the rest of time. So if you can effectively crack the hydrogen from the water and then reuse it and recapture the water vapor when you burn it, you're not using any net water, but you're taking advantage of the plethora of low-cost renewable energy resources we have in the Northwest to crack the water in the first place. So the answer is you get a ton of ammonia you can get 2 tons of ammonia per day for every megawatt of energy that goes into cracking the water, combining it with nitrogen, and forming green ammonia and then regenerating it.
So am I understanding you correctly to say essentially you're borrowing the water as well and it goes back?
What happens is you take a piece of, let's imagine the Columbia River in a small piece, you take a piece of that low-cost energy at night from the Columbia River or in the spring and the wind energy that blows at night when we're all sleeping and we don't need it but it can't be stored. Take a piece of that combination of non-fuel hydro and wind energy. You use that energy to crack the water and to bring the hydrogen and nitrogen from the atmosphere through machines that exist today. You temporarily store that, let's say at night, just for a few hours. Or you can store it for a season in the spring and wait till the summer when the energy peaks hit. You transport that green ammonia fuel to the middle of Portland and you run it through generators that then generate power precisely on peak when it's worth 10 times as much to the power grid. It's these peaks that causes utilities to build new coal plants and new nuclear plants. So if you shave these peaks at the center of load, you essentially are using the Columbian pieces to shave power peaks, and since you can recapture the water in the hydrogen hub and reuse it at the center, at the beginning for, again, a source of hydrogen, it's a perfectly, literally a perfectly renewable fuel.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Help me understand just a little bit here. Are we talking about reacting hydrogen across a catalyst to create electricity, or are we talking about combusting?
The first thing we're talking about is electrolyzing the hydrogen.
Okay.
So we're going to take a water, we're going to run it through large-scale, megawatt-size electrolyzers, split the water into hydrogen and oxygen. There is a new technology we're looking at called the solid-state ammonia synthesis process, which actually does the same thing, but does it about 25% more efficiently than the electrolyzers that exist today. And because efficiency is very important in this process, we're looking constantly for the next best technology, and that's one of the things the Alliance has been created to do, to help invest in new technologies that can increase the efficiency of this total loop.
So I guess my question is not at the beginning of the cycle, but at the end of the cycle.
Yeah.
So once you have your ammonia,
yeah,
the transition, unlocking the energy from that ammonia, I assume it's not combusted. I assume it is reacted to
electricity. No, actually, it's combusted.
It is combusted.
And what we're doing is working with companies to... actually, there's a history of using ammonia as a fuel. The Belgian bus fleet in World War II ran mostly on ammonia when the Nazis stole their diesel fuel. The X-15 aircraft, the first aircraft that broke the sound barrier 30, 40 years ago, ran on pure ammonia fuel. And people don't realize that because they don't think of ammonia as a fuel, and that's kind of where the breakthrough notion is here in terms of the density of hydrogen. So we will run ammonia through very combustion turbines and diesel engines, formerly diesel engines that look and act a lot like what utilities use today. They're designed differently. They don't have copper or brass in them because ammonia can degrade that, but put stainless steel systems in it. We will run it through those engines. We could run it through your car engine, and the combustion product... If you run ammonia through it, because it's only hydrogen and only nitrogen, the combustion products are going to be water vapor and nitrogen back into the atmosphere that's already 78% nitrogen. So it is a combustion system at the end.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Please.
Thank you. So if you're combusting NH3 and the nitrogen is going back into the ecosystem, is it released as pure nitrogen or as NOx compounds?
It's released as pure nitrogen. Under certain narrow circumstances, and under certain temperatures, the combustion inside the system can produce a little bit of NOx. But the interesting thing about ammonia is it's a natural cleansing agent mm-hmm. for NOx itself, and so we simply use a little bit of the ammonia we've got to capture that NOx on site and keep it out of the air. If it happens, and it doesn't happen all the time.
Go ahead.
Just on a slightly different line, I'm just trying to understand.
Sure.
This is new to me. So, would it be a correct characterization to say that in some sense, the method of converting first cracking water and then converting to ammonia is in some sense a chemical battery to store energy and transfer it from one form to another?
That's exactly what's going on. You're taking a natural system like hydropower or wind power, and you are temporarily storing it chemically in a bond of NH3. This is the important piece, because if it's stored chemically in a bond, you don't have to put in a lot of energy to push the atomic structures together and hold them there. So it's quite elegant as a method of storing hydrogen temporarily until you combust it. So it's a large, think of it as a renewable energy battery made up of anhydrous ammonia, which is really only hydrogen and nitrogen. Now, let me just say, the important thing is there's 100 million tons of anhydrous ammonia that are made around the world every year and transported around the world, mostly for agriculture. This is the backbone of global agriculture, is the movement of anhydrous ammonia. On trains, on trucks, on barges, on ships, there's a massive infrastructure to move this, and it's moving it all the time. The problem is the ammonia that's made in the world is made from carbon sources in Russia and Trinidad and Tobago and Venezuela, from either natural gas or a coal in a steam methane reforming process, but it's got a big carbon exposure. Anhydrous ammonia that you buy right now under your sink is made with carbon-based fuels, therefore is one of the biggest carbon exposure on the planet. What we're proposing to do is substitute that carbon-based fuel as the energy source to combine nitrogen and hydrogen together in ammonia. We're going to substitute that with off-peak renewable energy resources from the Columbia River, from wind, from solar. And we're going to use that energy to combine them, which creates a green ammonia, a renewable ammonia, which is then as burned becomes a capturable and renewable resource. And we have thousands of megawatts, tens of thousands of megawatts, nuclear plants worth of excess energy that comes down the Columbia River and blows from wind farms in this region every spring, for example, that is way beyond the region's capacity to absorb and is therefore sold for dimes on the dollar. This spring it got so bad we were actually paying people to store that renewable energy. And 2 months later, at the height of the summer season, when everyone turned on their air conditioners, the price of that energy went up by tenfold. So this is a temporary storage medium, and we're reshaping the Columbia River and wind power and solar energy, storing it and putting it precisely where it's needed. And in the bargain, because we're putting the generation source at the center of cities, We think we'll save hundreds of millions of dollars in the long run in having to build new wires, new transmission systems, the kind of thing that are only built to bring carbon-based distant power sources across the mountains into urban areas where it's used. We're going to generate that power in scalable amounts, precisely what utilities need at the center of cities with zero pollution.
So I think I'm confused on one thing. Maybe you have follow-ups as well, but let me clarify something real quick. At one point, I heard you say the water, or maybe I thought I heard you say water is borrowed, essentially, and goes back. And another point, I thought I heard you say it is essentially released as vapor. Does it go back? And so wondering about the relationship with use for agriculture and other sorts
of... So let's start in simple terms. You start with 420 gallons of water is what it takes when you run it through this process to make a megawatt of electricity, or sorry, one ton of ammonia. So 420 gallons goes into making one ton of ammonia. Okay. And so since we're creating the ammonia from green energy sources, it's green ammonia that's sitting in the tank, but we've used 420 gallons of water in doing so. Okay, so water becomes the basic fuel because you're electrolyzing the water. Now, there's two things you can do with that ammonia. You can run it through a power generation system designed to run on ammonia to use ammonia as a fuel, or you can sell that green ammonia to farms and agriculture. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing is it's organic fertilizer because it's coming from electricity from renewable energy, hydrogen from water, and air from the air, and then it's going back into it. If you use it as a fertilizer on farms, you cannot recapture the water because the fertilizer goes on the farm. It's absorbed slowly back into the air, so in a large sense it does get recaptured by the atmosphere, but you can't directly recycle it. If you use it in a generation system, if you use the green ammonia as a fuel for generation, you can put caps on the emissions of that control systems on the emissions of that generator and recapture the water vapor when the hydrogen comes out, hits oxygen, and formulates water again. You simply recapture that, you re-tube it back to the beginning of the process and use that same water as a hydrogen, electrolyzed hydrogen, to electrolyze hydrogen again. So my scientists tell me actually there's little or no water lost if you recapture it for generation. It is lost in a small sense. It's not lost in a big sense if you put it on the ground for fertilizer. But we think hydrogen hubs offer agriculture in the region an interesting alternative to this carbon-based, Russian-based, Venezuelan-based crucial component to global agriculture. We can create our own green organic ammonia for reasonable prices from regional power sources, and we don't have to depend on anybody else for that. And that becomes very important long-term to the stability of one of our more important industries.
That's very helpful. Thank you. Other questions? Sam Bailey?
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. So I'm just curious if you can help shed some light on some of the efficiencies in this method, say, versus hydrogen in a fuel cell or through a central power plant in production. I'm thinking it's essentially a battery and you're taking mechanical energy, changing it to electrical energy, changing it back to chemical energy through a cracking, and then changing it to heat energy through combustion, and then changing it back to mechanical energy. How do the losses in there compare to line losses in transmission, and how does that compare to, say, catalyzing across a membrane?
Well, line losses in transmission are about 3%. Transmission systems are very efficient, but the problem is because we're putting all of our energy resources east of the mountains, whether it's wind or natural gas fire generation or coal or whatever, it's all east of the mountains, and we got to build more and more transmission systems to send that power to increasing demand in urban areas like Portland and Seattle and Eugene and so on. What happens is those transmission systems are getting full during peak transmission times, and so you have to pay congestion fees, and you have to expand the transmission system to widen it. That has environmental implications. You have to build corridors through the Cascades to expand transmission lines in order to bring more and more distant power, even wind power, because wind power is also distant power, across the Cascades, down the valleys, and into the center of load at the cities. Hydrogen hubs are not as efficient as 3% loss. You lose energy in the translation of hydropower and wind power through to power generated at site. But the key thing is you can make the ammonia fuel, green ammonia fuel, in eastern Oregon by big wind sites, create the fuel, transport it by barge down the river to the generation site, and in doing so you generate power from the inside of the demand area out, so you save millions of dollars in additional poles and wires. Now, so there's a great efficiency in putting it there. The mechanical efficiency right now with existing technology of translating a megawatt of power going into this loop and a megawatt coming out on peak at the center of load is about 4 to 1. That's what so you put 4 units of energy in to get one out at the center of load with zero pollution. And what we need to do is increase it. And even with that, because the cost of the power you're using that's going in is maybe 1 or 2 cents in the spring, a kilowatt hour, and the value of the power out coming out is worth 10 or 12 or 14 cents on peak at the center of load, not counting all these savings, not counting green credits and so on, it's still a very, very good value because you're putting the power precisely where you want it. Mm-hmm. And our objective is to, as I said earlier, is to constantly increase that efficiency faster. This is the first generation stuff that's off-the-shelf technology. The next generation, we think, is going to be significantly more improving of that ratio.
So I'm noting the time and the fact that we're losing a little bit of our committee here. I want to give you a chance to tell us a little bit more about the demonstration project and where your process is in that regard.
We're working with Bonneville, other utilities in the region, to finish up a feasibility engineering study, which is one purpose of which is to design a prototype 10-megawatt, 5,000-home peak energy system. We want to finish the study in May. We want to have a prototype finance. We want utilities to put in matching funds. We want to try to get funding potentially from the federal stimulus package associated with smart grid technologies or green technologies. It works for both. It works for everything, really, because it does so many things. Hydrogen hubs do. And we want to get a prototype up and running next year. So we want to start funding the end of this year, so the study hopefully will enable that. We'll pick a site. We will then build this demonstration. We will get it up and running. We'll let people like you come visit it, see how it works, kick the tires, cut the ribbon, and then if it works the way we see it, we want to then franchise the notion of hydrogen hubs to utilities, not just in the region, but to other parts of the country and the world, and thereby create a long-term Oregon-centered industry here based on this new technology.
Representative
Galizio. Yeah, for a comment and then a question. I just wanted to assure you, Mr. Chair, that Representative Gilliam told me before this that he was going to summarize everything that was said today for Representative Thatcher.
Especially the science part. Right?
Yes, exactly. So I just wanted to thank you in advance and make sure that the Chair knew that.
Well, thank you.
Mike, so are you...
Representative Gilliam a net negative or liability?
For no, not at all.
I just want to make sure.
No. Okay. He represents his area very well. So are you working with any of our institutions of higher education or scientists?
We are working. We created this 501c3, the Northwest Hydrogen Alliance, specifically to allow public and private institutions, including universities, to come in and work on perfecting hydrogen hubs and the technologies. We're starting with utilities who are helping finance this final study, but we expect to bring in independent scientists, you know, folks from universities in Oregon to test, to verify that we have zero emissions, to try help us with increasing the efficiencies of pass-through technologies. And so we're looking forward to, and environmental groups like the Bonneville Environmental Foundation, who we're also talking to about potentially a role in what we see here. So we are designing this to bring in as many different institutions as we can within the context of understanding we are trying to drive a technology solution home, which we think is practical and workable, and we want to maintain a national lead on it. So people coming in have to understand this is an entrepreneurial venture. We want to succeed. We want to create jobs. We want to get their help, but we are interested in moving this along in order to capture the potential we think is out there right now, given the focus the country's got on smart grid technology and green power.
It's probably a good place to conclude. Really glad you came. I hope you'll keep in touch with us, and perhaps when your study is concluded, I think it's likely we'll still be here. Maybe we'll be really successful and efficient in our own operations and be gone, but I think there'd be a chance for you to come back and give us an update. We sure appreciate
I appreciate
that.
Your support. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, guys. If there are any other comments, we will adjourn, and see you on Thursday.
Chair,
Representative Bailey.
Representative Gilliam for arranging this very interesting discussion.
And Mr. Chair, at 5:15, for other members who haven't heard this, but if any of you have questions, we're doing an additional briefing with Jack, 5:15, fourth floor, House conference room.
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We're adjourned.